The Hollywood summer movie season opens this weekend. That's what the trades say. And with it comes the film industry's hopes for a long list of box office blockbusters and the inevitable deluge of sequels, remakes, and reboots. Topping this summer's list, Iron Man 3, Star Trek Into Darkness, Man of Steel, I wonder what that one's about, The Hangover 3, and a remake of The Great Gatsby starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Our midday critics, Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, take a look at the new crop of big-budget do-overs, and we compare notes on films that had a second coming, for better or worse. Midday on film, on remakes and sequels, after the news. Back to midday, everyone. I just posted a photograph of Jeff Bridges from the Coen Brothers film True Grit, 2010, 2011. I don't remember what year it was, but I thought it was a great remake of the original True Grit starring John Wayne. That's my vote for the greatest remake of all time, having thought about this for about 10 minutes today. But we can give it more thought during this hour of the show. I want you all to think about it and phone in. Talk about remakes and sequels on today's Midday on Film with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, our midday contributors and critics on film. It's Midday on Film, the subject today, remakes and sequels, brought to us because the summer movie season is upon us. Even though it's still spring, the trades say the summer movie season begins this weekend. It started at midnight last night with Iron Man 3. Chris, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Dan. Thanks.
Linda, as always, welcome. It's wonderful to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Dan.
And this is an original Midday on Film you're listening to. This is not a rebroadcast. This is not a remake. This is fresh material today, right?
It is. Good. The original take one.
What is it with remakes? Iron Man 3 came out last night, directed by Shane Black, J.J. Abrams, Star Trek Into Darkness, Justin Lin's Fast and Furious 6, the Superman origin reboot, Man of Steel. Some people will want to know what a reboot is, Chris, so we'll go over that today as well. The Hangover 3, Hugh Jackman reprises his role as the Wolverine in a film called The Wolverine. And, of course, Leonardo DiCaprio in the role of Robert Redford in the role of, what's his name? What was the character from The Great Gatsby?
Jay
Gatsby. Thank you very much. The other one was Nick. What's his name? Okay.
Carraway.
Nick Carraway. Okay, so The Great Gatsby is coming out. That is a remake of a 1970s film.
Which was itself a remake of two previous versions, 1949 with Alan Ladd and 1926 with Warner Baxter. So this, and there have been a few other versions that people know less about.
So four times a charm.
Four times, but actually there was a version in 2000 with Mira Sorvino and Paul Rudd, and in 2002... a kind of hip-hop version called G.
No kidding.
Yeah, so there have been five previous versions minimum.
I just said a little while ago, I'm glad we're doing this subject today because I actually find it interesting once I spend more than 10 minutes looking into it in preparation for today's show. And Linda says, yeah, it's interesting, but it's also sad.
It's very sad.
Yeah, when you think about go ahead. It is sad in a way, right?
Well, it's sad when you think about the proliferation of sequels and remakes and reboots over the last, especially the last even 10 years. It's increased dramatically. So that pretty much today, especially during the summer season when the studios roll out their tentpole movies, which support all the good stuff that they make the rest of the year.
Can I stop you there for a minute? Mm-hmm. They're tentpole movies.
Yes.
I'm just Linda DeLibero, Johns Hopkins University, Director of Film and Media Studies. Tentpole. Thank you very much.
Yeah. That's why
I want to give you. I want to attribute that to you. Yes.
Thank you. Yes, I invented that term. In fact, but today the summer movies are almost all remakes, reboots, sequels, etc. There are very few original movies, and that's probably not going to change anytime soon. It's only going to get more so. And this is kind of a problem because there are no original ideas floating around. And when there are, they can't get made because the truth of the matter is sequels, no matter how bad they are, always make money. It's incredible, but it's true. I looked it up.
You answered my question without my having to say why. I would say why Hollywood, these big production companies don't want to take chances, but they know they're gonna make some money if they do a sequel.
Yeah, and the more precarious, the theater system is that filmmaking gets, the more it's gonna be that way because. You know, it's always better to go with a sure thing. It's just too risky to go with something new.
Go with the brand that you know. And I think we can trace a lot of these current trends back to the invention of the modern blockbuster in the 70s. Because Hollywood had a hard time with the destruction of the studio system in the 60s and 70s. And then they figured it out with movies like Jaws and Star Wars, the Spielbergs and the Lucases. And then if you go back to that era and move forward, you'll see an increasing number of films that are sequels to those kinds of films, and then eventually the remakes and the reboots. And I once read a book about the history of Hollywood, the very first sentence of which was something like this: never forget that the business of Hollywood is making money. Everything else is incidental. So yes, they'll sometimes, make great art, very entertaining pictures, but the number one reason for Hollywood's existence, like any business, is to make money. And so if it makes money, they'll make it.
All right, given what you just said, I want to go back on The Great Gatsby for a moment. You said there were two earlier versions before the Redford version of the 70s, 74 or
74
something.
Is the Redford one, yeah.
Why did they do remakes then? Was it because a director or a writer said, we can do that better?
Well, I think, and Linda and I were talking about this about a month ago when we first started thinking about the show. You can basically divide sequels and remakes into sort of the mercenary, which is just, hey, it's a title that people know, so if we make it again, there's a chance that it'll be recognizable and people will come to see it. And then there's sort of that meaningful sequel where, of course, they want to make money, but they have an idea. And those are, of course, my preferred kinds of sequels. I respect that they want to make money, but if they're actually making the film for reasons beyond that, such as, I'd like to try it this way, or, yeah, that was a great first film, but now I have a great idea for a sequel, and we'll take the story in this direction, those can actually be quite good. But when it's just about, hey, Iron Man made money, let's make Iron Man 2,
right.
Then it can be problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think this is a problem now more than it was in the studio era. I mean, studios want to make lots of money too. But the people who ran the studios, and this is something that people have said forever, but it's true, people who ran the studios during the golden age loved movies by and large, and they had a hands-on approach to them, and they wanted to make certain projects because they knew movies. Today, all the studios, such as they are owned by multimedia conglomerates, most of which have nothing to do with film. And there's one thing that they care about and one thing only, and it ain't movies.
And those people that you're referring to from the studio era, they probably even read novels, the novels that inspired
quite
films,
possibly.
Right?
Or, let's not go that far. They read treatments of novels.
Okay, all right.
But occasionally, you would have
That Barton Fink feeling.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that guy. You're referring, that guy. Yeah, referencing right. Barton Fink is an excellent, that's what it was like. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to give the phone number again because I would like to hear from folks about remakes and sequels of movies and how you feel about them. Are we all suckers that because we see a Batman 1, Batman whatever it was, a Batman in a title, you gotta go because it's gonna be good, right? Okay, maybe. 410-662-8780. I've heard so many people say that they're disappointed with sequels, that they think sequels get to be a joke after a while, almost a parody of the original. Yet from what Linda's saying, is they make money, so people obviously still go to them.
Although, you do have occasionally good remakes, reboots, and sequels. You mentioned Batman. The whole Christopher Nolan series really took it in an interesting direction, although I didn't like the third film as much as the first two. And then there's Aliens, which for me remains one of the greatest sequels ever made because it was made 7 years after the original. It was a new director, James Cameron. Ridley Scott had done the original film. And he clearly had an idea what he wanted to do with the film. And whereas the first film is this kind of thriller,
ooh,
horror film set in space, film is an action-adventure film.
Was,
and so it's
was.
A very different feel, and it really, I thought, did interesting things with the story and with the central character, Ripley, played by Sigourney Weaver.
Let's listen to a clip from Aliens.
Look, I don't have time for this. I've got to get going. I've got to go to work.
All right. I heard you're working in the cargo docks.
That's right.
Running loaders and forklifts, that sort of thing?
So?
Nothing. I think it's great that you're keeping busy. And I know it's the only thing that you could get. There's nothing wrong with it. What would you say if I told you I could get you reinstated as a flight officer? The company has already agreed to pick up your contract.
If I go.
Yeah, if you go. Come on, that's a second chance, kiddo. And I think personally for you, it would be the best thing in the world to get out there and face this thing. Get back on the horse.
Spare me, Burke. I've had my psych evaluation this month.
Yeah, I know. I've read it. You wake up every night, your sheets are soaking with sweat.
I said no, and I mean it. Now, please leave. I am not going back, and I would not be any good to you if I did.
Yeah. You know what? Can I say something? What I liked about the first two films in that series was all this working man dialogue, people talking about the work they had to do, how much they hated it, the hardware that they had to deal with, the shift work, basically. And there's more of that in there. It's like working man dialogue out of a lunchroom anyplace, but this is in space.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that was a scene between Paul Reiser, who later became famous for Mad About You, the TV show.
Paul, can I stop you?
That was Paul Reiser, yeah.
That was Paul Reiser.
You didn't recognize his voice?
Now I do. You know who's going to be on this show sitting in your chair next Friday at this time?
Who?
Paul Reiser.
Oh, my God.
He's coming to Baltimore to be at Magoobie's Joke House. He's doing a stand-up.
I'm going to sneak in and get him to sign my copy of Aliens.
That's where he's come. Don't say anything. Oh. But he's going to be here next week.
Wow.
Please continue.
Oh, yeah, sure. So he plays a corporate hack who's there to sort of convince Ripley. It's what sets
sleaze.
The sequel in motion.
He's
a
sleaze.
In the movie, he's a total sleaze, and he ends up getting his comeuppance. And as you can hear, it sets the plot in motion exactly when she says, I'm not going back. You know, of course, that she's going to have to go back and confront the aliens.
Yeah, but the thing about the movie is that it's largely character-driven, and it features a wonderful performance by Sigourney Weaver. It's very unusual because it's all about the woman, and that's the thing that you don't see in a lot of sequels today. They are not character driven. You don't know anything about these people. It's all about explosions, and partly I think that's because the studios are kind of training generations of watchers who want this only and don't know anything different. You know, kids play video games, and the video games are that's where the movies are coming from. And that's what that's all about. And they're smart. They know exactly what they're doing when they purchase comic book franchises and video game franchises. And it's just all a kind of closed circuit of entertainment.
Now, what about Heath Ledger's character in Dark Knight?
That's a
because wouldn't that would sort of counter a little bit? I mean, I'm right on with what you're saying.
It's an exception.
It's an exception in this era, right? Let's listen to this. What is this clip?
So this is a clip from a movie that qualifies as both a remake or reboot because it's starting a series over with different actors. And this is a sequel. This is from Dark Knight, the second in the Christopher Nolan Batman series. It's a scene between Christian Bale as Batman and Heath Ledger as the Joker. And they were played by Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson in the original Tim Burton film. And in this scene, they're in an interrogation room. They've caught the Joker, but maybe he wanted to be caught, because listen to the dialogue and how he's taunting Batman.
You wanted me. Here I am.
I wanted to see what you'd do.
And you didn't disappoint. You let 5 people die. Then you let Dent take your place. Even to a guy like me, that's cold.
Where's Dent?
Those mob fools want you gone so they can get back to the way things were. But I know the truth. There's no going back. You've changed things. Forever.
Then why do you want to kill me?
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No, no. No. No, you. You complete me.
You're garbage. You kills for money.
Don't talk like one of them. You're not.
I mean, that's the one, probably there might be some other exceptions, but that's an exception to this rule that you've described, Linda.
Yeah. It's the whole phenomenon of first of all, you know, the Nolan series, he does try to do something significantly different with this franchise. And then you have an actor like Heath Ledger, you know, doing something completely different. But it's interesting because this continuing trope of anarchy and chaos that runs through many, many of these blockbuster action films where everything is about a kind of nihilistic worldview.
Well, you have to have a dystopia in order for the heroes to, you know, save us from it in a sense. But that just goes back to what you're saying about Nolan, the mercenary versus the meaningful, that mm-hmm. he has an idea. That's why this series is so interesting.
We're talking about remakes and sequels and reboots, and a little bit more on reboots after this break when we get back here. Linda DeLibero is Director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Christopher Llewellyn Reed, I'm happy to say now, Professor of Film and Video at the Stevenson University in the School of Design. Film Video Department, the School of Design at Stevenson University, our regular midday on film contributors, remakes and sequels. Let's hear your comments. 410-662-8780. Welcome back. Midday on Film with Linda DeLibero, Christopher Llewellyn Reed. Comment on the new Gatsby film from Mark. He says, I'm not sure about Tobey Maguire playing Nick Carraway. I think Sam Waterston was great in the 1974 version. How was the 1974 version?
Well, I think Sam Waterston was the best part of it because the couple of versions I've seen of Gatsby before this one, I think have gotten all the other characters largely wrong in terms of the casting. But I think Sam Waterston was quite solid. So I'd be curious to see how DiCaprio, who seems like a natural fit for Gatsby, does, although he's, we'll see. I don't have high hopes based on the other films I've seen, but it could surprise me.
Linda?
You
know, what about the Redford film?
The 74 film, you know, I watched it again, and I remember not liking it the first time I saw it, and nothing really changed my opinion. It's sort of stillborn. It's really turgid. It's slow. You don't really, you know, I have a problem with why people keep trying with Gatsby. It's not really a filmable novel. And when I go see the Baz Luhrmann film, which inevitably I will do, I'm going in, I don't think you can go in thinking, oh, this is going to be the remake of Gatsby. It's going to be what
keep
it is.
Keep your expectations low.
Yeah, and enjoy it for what it's going to be, spectacle.
I'll keep my expectations very low, and maybe I'll like it, because Baz Luhrmann does have a very florid cinematic style, so maybe it will work for the book. I agree it's largely unfilmable, but
we'll see. The farther away it is from the original, the better it's going to be.
I agree. I remember that novel being taught in high school or college, I can't remember, but I do remember the comment, not a wasted word, the great American novel, incredible writing by F. Scott Fitzgerald, and not a wasted word. And I had trouble reading that one. I like other Fitzgerald, Tender is the Night.
I love Tender is the Night.
I had trouble even reading The Great Gatsby. Let's go to the phone lines. I want to hear from our listeners here. Ben in Baltimore, thanks for joining us on Midday on Film.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I guess mine is just a comment. I'm a big movie fan, and it was a good way for me to really come into America when I moved here in 1992. It was an eye-opener for me. And in Baltimore, where I work as a nurse, you know, every time I go into people's homes, I follow the soap operas from one house to the next. And it's pretty much how I feel about movies now. Everybody's been conditioned first through the comic books with all the action movies, and now into picture, into the movies, and it just loses its flavor. And I can understand her expression, one of your guests' expressions of how she would feel watching The Great Gatsby. And I feel that way about a lot of the movies that are being made as sequels, because there's really nothing new, nothing original. It's all based on money, and you see this translated into people's lives when they watch.
And Ben, you're thinking TV has influenced this, because people are used to watching something in serial. Of course, there used to be serials at the movie houses too, right?
There did. First, there were radio serials. Then there were serials in the movie houses. And then, of course, we started having television, soap operas, but, you know, series, long-running series. And now what we're seeing is this incredible cinematic approach to long-form drama on TV, largely thanks to cable. Mm-hmm. So I think the lines are being blurred a little bit between kind of what we expect.
What about that influence,
Linda? And that's where the soap opera, well, the thing about a soap opera is that you see these characters every day, and you really get to feel as if you know them, that they're your friends and neighbors. And as silly as it may seem, there is some character development, although it can, you know, it can reboot.
It can take years.
It can take years and years. But that sense of familiarity, that's at the core of the idea of the sequel, is that you go into the theater and, God forbid, you should encounter the unexpected or anything that you're not familiar with or anything that you have to grapple with. It's easy. It's very easy. It's comforting. There's something very, you know, gives a sense of stability. No matter how much the world is being rocked, you've seen it before and you know what to expect. And that's a lot of people like that.
Mm-hmm. David in Essex, we'll go to you next. Thanks for joining us on Midday.
Hey, I just want to ask the guests, why, when they keep doing these sequels, they do the origin all over again? You know, the last Spider-Man came out, I was so disappointed because he gets stung by the spider. He fights the bully.
Okay, this gives me a great opportunity to ask Christopher Llewellyn Reed about reboots. And this Man of Steel film is considered a Man of Steel Superman origin reboot?
It is.
What exactly does it mean?
A reboot is a term usually applied to the restart of a series rather than just a pure remake. So it can either be rebooting of a TV show, it can either be rebooting of a movie that had multiple, you know, films as part of a series, either two sequels, three sequels, etc. It's when you start over from the beginning, and it's usually done in the hopes of starting a new, and there's that word, franchise. It's all about branding. Yeah. And that is, in fact, why they start over with the origin story a lot of time, because they're hoping to get a new actor involved in what might be, for the current audience's mind, that character. Mm-hmm. So we have this guy, Henry Cavill, who's known for the TV show The Tudors, where he plays Charles Brandon. I haven't seen the show, but that's kind of his biggest hit to date. And he's going to be playing Clark Kent, a.k.a. Superman. And they want to do with him what they tried to do with Brandon Routh in 2006 when they didn't restart the series, but they tried to launch a new actor. So they're taking an approach to kind of, hey, let's relaunch Superman. It was great in the 1970s. We made Christopher Reeve's career. Let's try to have a new franchise version. And that's what Christopher Nolan did with The Dark Knight, except he was very successful in creating a new vibe so people tuned in.
I want to go to another clip that Chris Reed prepared for us. Why is The Departed on this list of remakes or sequels?
It's a remake of a 2002 Hong Kong action police procedural Infernal Affairs that was quite successful in its home country and developed sort of a cult following over here for people who like Hong Kong action films. Hmm. And Martin Scorsese remade it in 2006, and it won 4 Oscars. It got him an Oscar for Best Picture, Best Director, it got Best Editing, and Best Adapted Screenplay.
What is this scene?
So this is a scene between Leonardo DiCaprio, who plays a police mole who's infiltrated the mob. And in order to seem realistic, he's allowed himself to be arrested. And now he's been released from prison. And this is a scene with his police psychologist, who he has to see as part of his parole.
There was a cop leaving when I came in.
How did you know he was a cop?
You know, bad haircut, no dress sense, and a slight, you know, air of scumbag entitlement. Do you see cops?
That's part of what I do. I mean, I normally don't see cadets who've been kicked out of the academy.
Oh, boy. You should get a better job, huh?
Should I?
So, do they all come in here and cry, your cops?
Sometimes they do. Yeah, sure. Sometimes they cry, yeah. If they've had trouble at home, if they've had to use their weapons.
Use their weapons? Let me tell you something. They signed up to use their weapons, most of them, all right? But they watch enough TV so they know they have to weep after they use their weapons. There is no one more full of than a cop, except for a cop on TV.
Appreciate the TV comment there. So thank you for the background on that. I wasn't aware of the background of The Departed. So that qualifies as a remake of, and we see that a lot, don't we? See French film, foreign films remade into American films,
particularly, right? French films traditionally. Yeah. Although now we as a country see more films from other countries than just French. But for a long time, it always seemed like a successful French film would be remade in America.
There's
and
some
English.
Famous
comedies,
examples of that.
Mostly.
Comedies, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was also thinking of, is it Le Jeté? Le Jeté.
Le Jeté, 12 Monkeys, yeah.
It's 12
that's
Monkeys.
One of the most interesting remakes
it is,
ever.
It is.
Very, you would never imagine that the source material would yield a film like 12 Monkeys.
Yeah. Now, here's a film that some people have on their list as the greatest sequel, among the greatest sequels, or maybe the greatest sequel. Peter writes in to say, my vote for best sequel goes to Godfather 2. Great performances by De Niro and Pacino, and Chris prepared a clip for this of this too.
Yeah, this is a scene between Michael and his brother Fredo, his older brother Fredo, who's always been treated because he's not very smart as a kind of young sibling.
Smart.
Yeah, I know. That's what the scene's about. And this is between Pacino and the late great John Cazale, who died far too young at 42 in the late 70s. And basically what's happened before this is Fredo, being not very smart, allowed himself to be manipulated into assisting a potential but failed hit on Michael. And Michael's confronting him about this and how he could have been involved.
You believe that story? You believe that?
He said there was something in it for me, on my own.
I've always taken care of you, Fredo.
Taking care of me? You're my kid brother and you take care of me? Did you ever think about that? Huh? Did you ever once think about that? Send Fredo off to do this. Send Fredo off to do that. Let Fredo take care of some Mickey Mouse nightclub somewhere. Send Fredo to pick somebody up at the airport. I'm your older brother, Mike, and I was stepped over.
That's the way Pop wanted it.
It ain't the way I wanted it. I can handle things. I'm smart. Not like everybody says. Like, dumb, I'm smart, and I want respect.
Poor Fredo. Poor Fredo. So, Linda, that film has been out for 40 years, mm-hmm. Godfather 2. Do you remember how you felt about it then, how you feel about it now as a sequel, as a standalone film?
Those two films are arguably the greatest American films ever made. And I think that... unusually enough, you would get my students to agree to that. Many of them have seen the film a million times, mm-hmm. as I have. And that is a true original. There isn't anything like it. And of course, I'd argue that it is definitely the greatest sequel.
Sometimes I don't even think of it as a sequel. I think of it as a story that stands on its own.
Well,
even though I realize it's
they are right. integral to each other.
Oh, yeah.
To see both of them together is to understand how one enriches the other, and it's almost those films would never be made today. Never.
And then we had the unfortunate Godfather 3.
Oh, God, let's not talk about that.
You didn't want me to bring it up?
No, I'm joking. I'm just saying it's so terrible.
We say remakes and sequels for better or worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like, why did you even do this? Sometimes they have a why did they even bother reaction to certain films.
Well, I think that goes to the mercenary aspect of it, mm-hmm. although I'm pretty sure Coppola probably thought he was making a meaningful third film. I don't think they set out to make something terrible, although it didn't help that he cast his daughter in a central role. Sofia Coppola, who's a fine director, but was not a great actress.
Yeah, that was painful. I'm sorry to bring it up after the beautiful way Linda articulated the quality of the Godfather films.
Well, Godfather 2 is a true masterpiece of a sequel.
Let's go to the phone line. Another comment from one of our listeners here, Lane in Baltimore. Lane, thanks for calling the show.
Yeah, exactly. I just really feel like a lot of this kind of shift towards like a bigger view of content has to do with like the rise of video games that are not like character centric, and the popularity of comic books like Watchmen is not about a character, it's about a world. And I think that like Hollywood is kind of grasping at this like this interest, genuine growing interest in like people want to hear about bigger worlds and like see more like more perspectives rather than just the telling of one person's story. And I think they're just trying to like grapple with that and adapt to this like new front.
Do you think people, you think, as Linda was saying earlier, people want that, meaning a new generation wants that because they're used to being inside the world of a digital video game?
Well, yeah, video games do a lot for that. I mean, it used to be when you bought a video game, you would get a character out of the box that like Duke Nukem, whoever, it's like one guy.
Mm-hmm.
But now you get a game, you make a character, and just the fact that the way that you play it makes the story is like, that's so hard to adapt to a narrative telling form that they're really, they just try to come back like Avengers, five movies into one movie into a sequel or five sequels. You know, they're just trying to like tap into the whole universe rather than just one plot line.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's an interesting point. I would actually put that hand in hand with what I was starting to say earlier about long form drama. I think that because long-form drama that we see on TV, these long-running series, has actually gotten quite good, and things like Game of Thrones just go on and on and on, I think we're becoming used to watching these universes that don't really have a clear beginning, middle, and end. We just inhabit them. And I remember when The Hobbit prequel came out, how disappointed I was at how kind of formless and long it was. And then I realized for a lot of fans of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, that's besides the point. They get to go to the movie and spend 3 hours in this universe, and that's what counts. And it's just silly old me wanting to have a story with a clear beginning, middle, and end.
Right.
And I'm just, it's a different audience who responds to that.
Mm-hmm. Christopher Llewellyn Reed, Linda DeLibero, our contributors to Midday on Film. We'll take another break here. Looking for comments about remakes and sequels and reboots. Maybe you got into a sequel series and you really enjoyed it. Call in and tell us about it. 410-662-8780. What is your attitude when you go to see a remake? Do you think you'll go see The Great Gatsby? 410-662-8780. Comments by email at midday@wypr.org.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune,
or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to.
'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep, perchance to dream. There's the rub.
Wow. That was Sir Laurence Olivier, Melvin Gibson, Kenny Branagh, and Ethan Hawke doing Hamlet. That was put together by Christopher Llewellyn Reed, one of our people. Thank you very much. That was nicely done, Chris.
My pleasure. It was fun to do.
Yeah. Now, so Hamlet has been in film at least four times?
Oh, and I left out the Nicol Williamson one that Linda was just mentioning while we were listening to that.
Yeah. What do we say about Shakespeare? Noticed. I mean, Shakespeare has been done a few times in film, mm-hmm. and do we consider those? I guess they are remakes.
Well, they're remakes in the same way that you produce a play over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So there's the theatrical tradition behind it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because indeed there seems to be always with good material. An audience, and we're going to test that this summer with Joss Whedon's version of Much Ado About Nothing, which has gotten some very good critical response.
I think we have the trailer from that.
That's right, yeah. We have a short part of the trailer.
Oh, can we listen to that now? It's Much Ado About Nothing.
Well, niece, I hope to see you one day fitted with a husband.
Not till God make men of some other metal than earth.
I want you to get together.
It is certain I am loved of all ladies, for truly, I love none.
Dear happiness to women.
Put your hands together one time.
Oh, God, sir. I cannot endure my lady tongue.
There's a kind of merry war betwixt Signor Benedict and her. They never meet, but there's a skirmish of wit between them.
If you three will minister assistance, I will bring Signor Benedict and the Lady Beatrice into a mountain of affection.
By this day, she's a fair lady.
Oh, I like that. Now, what's going on here?
Well, Much Ado About Nothing is...
Oh, no, you don't have to tell us the plot. Oh.
I wanted Linda actually to go back over. Oh, what sure. did you just say? Who's producing this? Who's in this?
This is who's in this. Not nobody. No big stars okay. at all.
Clark Gregg is probably the closest to a well-known face in the film.
Okay,
but Joss Whedon is. You know, he directed the Avengers, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Okay,
came from TV to film. Extremely popular and successful. And this is a, although they are using the original Shakespeare, it is a modern day setting. So
oh, I get that.
It's contemporary. So it's going to be really interesting. And I have to say, it's to see the trailer with, you know, contemporary people speaking these lines. I thought, man, I don't know if that's going to work, but apparently it's quite good.
You know, the music that's used in trailers often has nothing to do with the film. It's not part of the soundtrack of the film, but this music that was used in that trailer, I just wonder what your comment is on that.
I don't know if the music is in the film, and it's by Saint-Germain with Rose Rouge as a singer. I love that particular piece, but I don't know if it's in the movie. And it really is kind of up to the editor of the trailer and the director of the studio whether they're going to make sure you hear the music from the film or come up with something else. But you do find that probably more than half the time the music you hear in a trailer is used in some way in the film.
In the film?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. There's another trailer we wanted to listen to here. Do we have it? The Iron Man 3 trailer? And what's the matter?
The Iron Man 3 is a clip that I gave
it's
you.
It's a clip?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you set it up?
Yes. This is, well, Linda saw the movie the other day, but I did not.
Oh, you saw it?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, what can you say about this clip?
This is Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, Iron Man. He's throwing down the gauntlet in challenge to the film's bad guy, who's called the Mandarin, played by Ben Kingsley. And it's just basically him talking to a bunch of reporters and then breaking one of their cameras at the end.
Okay.
Here's a little holiday greeting I've been wanting to send to the Mandarin. I just didn't know how to phrase it until now. My name is Tony Stark, and I'm not afraid of you. I know you're a coward. So I've decided that you just died, pal. I'm gonna come get the body. There's no politics here, it's just good old-fashioned revenge. There's no Pentagon, it's just you and me. And on the off chance you're a man, here's my home address. 10880 Malibu Point, 90265. I'll leave the door unlocked. That's what you wanted, right? Film me.
Is it? Okay, Linda. Jeff wrote in to say that he saw this trailer for Iron Man 3. He said, I didn't see the first two Iron Man films, but this looked interesting. What are your thoughts?
It's interesting. As an exemplar of everything that's wrong with sequels. You know, it's on the surface, it's fun. It's, you know, eye candy, a lot of explosions, a lot of things going on. And the thing about this particular franchise is that it centers around Robert Downey Jr.'s personality outside of the film, which is, you know, he's slightly above it all, a little hipper than thou, has a obvious kind of contempt for the material, kind of winking at us about, gee, I'm in this crazy superhero role, and me, Robert
Ooh.
Downey Jr.
Ooh, you're making all that money, and you're acting like that?
Smirk, smirk.
Yeah.
And
that would annoy me.
People love it. And
yeah,
yeah.
Do you
because
think, did
it,
he show
it's
that in the earlier films?
You and I are in on the joke.
Yeah.
We know that this stuff really sucks, but. You know, because we know it, we're above it. And you're sitting there and you're watching it and you're thinking, why am I watching it then? But there are other problematic things about the film, primarily, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but there are certain moments in the film, having seen the movie 2 weeks after the Boston Marathon bombing, that are more than a little disconcerting and kind of gets to the heart of what is so troubling today in the age of terrorism about these films and what they present to us as entertainment.
I didn't see the film. I saw Iron Man and Iron Man 2, and I really enjoyed in the first film Robert Downey Jr.'s shtick in the same way I sort of enjoyed Johnny Depp in the first Pirates of the Caribbean. And then with the subsequent films, it got to be a little old.
Exactly.
Manola Dargis in the New York Times had a review today about Iron Man 3 where she hit upon something that I'd felt actually in the first film, Iron Man, which is that although it was very entertaining, they used the trappings of dealing seriously with terrorism, kind of setting parts of the film in Afghanistan, to kind of make the film attempt to feel political and meaningful. But they did it in such a superficial way that in some ways, if you thought about it too much, it was kind of intellectually and politically offensive. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like this film does that even more. But I did enjoy the first Iron Man and even Iron Man 2. I'll probably go see Iron Man 3 because I'm a kid at heart. And I love these kinds of films, even when they're not that great. Yeah, I don't have high hopes, and maybe that'll help me like it.
Let's take another call about sequels and remakes. Teresa in Baltimore, thanks for holding. Go right ahead, Teresa.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to call to say that my husband and I both like science fiction and what I think is good science fiction. And I thought that the original Terminator was an absolutely excellent science fiction movie. It was a fantastic story. This feeling of this relentless predator, this woman who's in a nightmare world that this man tells her he's come back from the future, and she thinks she's gone, you know, her little normal world has just been turned upside down. It didn't have any particular special effects except that great one in the end when he burns up and it's just this metallic structure that's still, you know, coming together. The second ones were the most dreadful, sorry piece of movie making I have just about ever seen, and it totally turned me off. I realized, boy, have we been played for suckers. They knew, I think the original Terminator turned out to be so much more popular than perhaps they even realized, you know, with Arnold Schwarzenegger and his I'll Be Back. And I think they knew, boy, we can make a second one, and we can just rake them, get them to come in, and it was just, I thought it was
okay,
absolutely
Teresa,
dreadful.
My only comment about that would be, if you go to see a film and you connect with it and you really like it, not being a film critic, I don't have to go. I'm not obligated to go see as many films as Chris and Linda are, but I won't go see it. If I feel the first one was so special to me, somebody wants to do a sequel or worse, a remake, I may not bother with that film unless it just shows up on TV someday. What?
Well, I feel the same way, except that obviously now I have to see more movies than I used to. But but if I sense that it's not just purely mercenary, but that there's an idea, I'll go see it. I just want to quibble slightly with Teresa in that I loved the T2 sequel. I actually thought James Cameron did a very interesting thing with the story. And it was also a very interesting use of computer-generated effects because he had, what's that actor's name who plays?
I forget, but he had all those arms going
out. Well, yeah, he's basically a liquid Terminator.
It was amazing. It was
pretty
amazing.
And yeah. I liked the story. And the second thing I just want to say to Teresa is the first film did have a special effect. It was called Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Mm.
because
yeah.
He basically was this amazing effect for the film.
Let's go to Kenyatta. In Baltimore, we were talking about American remakes of foreign films. Hi, Kenyatta.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, my question for you in the panel or comment is that I just want you to discuss how some of the American remakes take some of the art and sexiness out of the remakes. I'm thinking about Leon the Professional to Leon that was done here, where they took the whole Lolita scene out of it, which kind of really was the art and soul of the movie.
Yeah, Linda, what would you say about that?
I try not to watch American remakes of French films.
Mm-hmm.
And
like The Birdcage?
That's
a comedy, so...
I thought that was actually a pretty good remake, but it's mostly the comedies, and French comedy, in the first place, I'm not that crazy about.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's what Kenyatta said about you take anything explicit or adult out of the scenario. The French are pretty nonchalant about sex and sophistication. That doesn't seem to bother them the same way it does American audiences and American producers. And I have to say the non-comedic movies that the French are making now are the kinds of movies that American directors were more free to make in terms of being about adults, sophisticated subject matter, new ways of approaching a narrative or the visuals. And, you know, I always pray that they don't take some of my favorite French movies and make them American, because they're not going to sell with the kinds of audiences that Hollywood producers need to sell to.
Yeah, I agree with what Linda's saying. I just wanted to add, for the listeners' sake, based off of Kenyatta's comments, if you ever want to see a really interesting remake in terms of exactly what he's saying, changing the sexiness or even kind of dealing with adult issues and sex and younger people, you should watch Insomnia, which is it was a Scandinavian film, which is remade with Al Pacino just a few years later.
And it's and, a very interesting... Robin Williams?
Yes, it's a very interesting shift. I'm not saying that all the issues the early film deals with are appropriate necessarily in terms of how the main character handles them, but just to see the shift in how the American remake changes how we view the main character, makes him less problematic, less dangerous, tells you a lot about the different mindsets in terms of how a European audience and an American audience, what their expectations are.
Yeah, it's called ambiguity.
Can I ask you two quickly? I wanted to ask you about Cape Fear. There was a remake with Robert De Niro of a James Robert Mitchum film. So what did you think of that?
Well, that just flips what I just said on its head, because in that film actually, but that's a remake of an earlier American film, but there the remake actually takes on some very dangerous issues in terms of teenage and adult sexuality that is very disturbing, but it's a Scorsese film, so what do you expect?
Right. And what about John Carpenter's The Thing? What about that? Do you remember?
I love that film. Yeah. 1982. It went up against E.T. and therefore did terrible box office. But I love that movie. That's a great remake.
Adam calling from Charles Street. Hello, Adam. Go right ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to get people's thoughts on the Indiana Jones franchise. And I really enjoyed the first three, but I thought the fourth one was horrendous. And on a second note, Shia LaBeouf was in the fourth one, and was also in Money Never Sleeps, the remake of Wall Street. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, he shows up in remakes.
He was also in Disturbia, which is a modern retelling of Rear Window. So maybe that's his thing. And he's in Transformers. He does lots of sequels, too. Mm. I loved the first and third Indiana Jones films. Loved, loved, loved them. But the second and the fourth ones both really disappointed me.
Okay, some comments from Mike in Hamden. He says, I agree with True Grit as a great remake. I always had problems with John Wayne riding through the Rocky Mountains in a story set in Arkansas. I think Jane Eyre is an all-time leader in remakes, and I think the most recent remake with Mia Wasikowska, what is it?
I think it's Mia Wasikowska, yeah.
Thank you very much. Is the best of the lot. He also says the girl with the dragon tattoo, the most recent effort that I considered a very good try at a sequel or a remake, I'm sorry, was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I recently watched the Swedish trilogy again and still find it superior. However, Earl in Abingdon says Dawn of the Dead, the one in the mall, the one that's set in the mall. It's faithful to the original themes, horrible and lighthearted, well-composed, and basically a better film than the original.
I don't know if it's better, but it's different, and I actually really like that film, which is by Zack Snyder, who's also now rebooting the Superman series this summer with Man of Steel.
And Linda, quickly, could you recommend The Seven Samurai to folks who might be familiar with The Magnificent Seven, or to the younger listeners who maybe aren't familiar with either?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Kurosawa's great epic of... when was that made? Early 60s, late 50s. And it's a lot of Westerns have been based off of Kurosawa's films. Clint Eastwood is a great fan. And I wouldn't say that Magnificent Seven is the greatest of the Kurosawa Westerns, but it's interesting to compare. And, of course, I highly recommend any Kurosawa movie.
Linda DeLibro is Director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Christopher Llewellyn Reed, Chair and Professor of the Film and Video Department out at Stevenson University. Both contribute to our Midday on Film Hour once a month. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Dan. It was a pleasure.
Yep.
Have a great weekend. I want to thank Two Boots Pizza, located at the juncture of Micah and UB on Mount Royal Avenue, for providing lunch for our guests today, providing pizza lunch. Two Boots serves po' boy salads, jambalaya pizza with a Cajun twist, including the famous Old Bay Beast featuring crab, crawfish, andouille sausage, and a healthy dose of jalapenos. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'll see you on Monday.